Risky Business, your weekly security briefing with Patrick Gray. Updating Tuesdays on itradio.com.au.
Hey, hey, and welcome to your Risky Business 55, hosted by the fine folks at Vigabyte Virtual Hosting, and brought to you this week by our sponsor Checkpoint Software. Well, we're back on deck after our Easter holidays here at itradio.com.au, and boy, I think I need a holiday to recover from my time off, let me tell you. It was a great Easter break, and I hope yours was as much fun as mine. But it's back to work for all of us, including the Risky Business crew, so we've prepared another show for you this week, even if it is a day late. We're giving our regular news segment a miss this week, and instead we'll focus on the Hanaford data loss incident in the US in a bit more detail, in place of the regular news segment with Maneer. So we'll be speaking with Brian Jericho Martin, one of the attrition.org crew, about that one. He helps to maintain the attrition.org data loss archive, the world's most comprehensive archive of its type. Over the last couple of weeks, it's been revealed the Hanaford chain of stores in the USA lost over 4 million records in a breach, and its customers aren't happy. They're now doing what Americans do best and suing Hanaford. We'll chat to Brian Martin to find out what it all means in just a moment. Our feature topic this week is somewhat related. Forensics. It's an expensive business, and Securus Global's Declan Ingram says Aussie companies are increasingly reluctant to foot the bill for a comprehensive forensic recovery. Prosecution is often a waste of time. The average Aussie customer just wants to get their systems back online and get back to business. It's an incident response approach. That interview is coming up later. And this week we'll also be taking an in-depth look into a news item we mentioned during last week's show. So in this week's sponsor interview with Aviv Abramovich, the senior security architect with Checkpoint Software, we're chatting about a nifty new iframe attack. The bad guys have found a really nice way to auto-pwn endpoints, particularly consumer endpoints. They find a website that caches its search results for search engine optimization purposes, and on that website, if it's also got cross-site scripting bugs, instead of searching for a car or for, you know, an auction item or whatever it is, the bad guys are injecting iframe code into search fields along with certain keywords. So those search results get cached by the website, indexed by Google, and soon enough, people doing legitimate Google searches start getting pwned by clicking through. So that one's coming up later. In the meantime, let's get into it. As we just mentioned, there's been another colossal data breach in the United States. The Hanaford chain of stores have finally come clean, admitting they've been majorly worked over by the bad guys. Now, if that wasn't bad enough, their customers are now engaging in America's favorite pastime, a class action lawsuit. It seems they're none too happy about their details being leaked and used by cyber mobsters, and now they're baying for blood. Brian Martin is one of the administrators of the attrition.org data loss archive, and he joined me by phone from the USA for this interview.
There's actually a lot of things going on. This breach is fairly different than many of them for many reasons. First off, not only did the credit information get taken, but there are over 1,000 incidents of abuse on those credit cards, apparently, or hundreds. So there's definitely a significant loss associated with this data breach, which is unlike most, where they say that the information was lost, but there's no known incidents of abuse.
So it wasn't like someone who'd left a taxi, left a laptop in the back of a taxi, and then it had been found by someone who wasn't really after the data, but got their little cousin to like format the hard drive so they could sell it on eBay.
Exactly, right. So this time, instead of the data likely being destroyed or just left unknown, it was definitely used for illicit purposes.
By people wearing dark hats and smoking cigars, those sort of guys.
Exactly.
Okay.
So on top of that, we have the fact that Hanaford kept the breach quiet as best they could for several months. They call it an ongoing investigation, but for many months this was going on, and they did nothing to stop it or prevent it from happening again.
So this was an ongoing investigation that was best conducted slowly and quietly.
Right.
Okay.
So combined with the fact that they let it keep happening and couldn't stop it, and it was being used for illicit purposes, that's what prompted many people to say, wait a minute, they stepped over the line And that is why we now see a lawsuit happening.
So why is it the domain of actual consumers to sue this company? Why isn't a U.S. regulator charged with that sort of responsibility?
Because like many parts of our government, they're just behind the times. You know, we don't have a nationwide law mandating that companies report the data breach. It's on a state-by-state basis here. So while we do have something like 40 or 41 states that mandate companies notify customers of a breach, that still leaves a good 10 that don't have to do it, and there's no national push to make them do it.
Okay. Well, one thing that I found was thought was interesting, actually. Recently, I don't know if you caught this, but someone went through the attrition archive and plotted out the 10 biggest data breaches since 2000 onto a timeline.
Right.
And they really noticed that the disclosure really accelerated towards where we are now. And some people said, oh, well, that means that these data breaches are getting much more common. But my thesis is that since the US states have passed laws requiring companies to disclose these types of incidents, it really is a matter that we're just finding out about it now. I mean, do you agree with that?
For the most part, yes. Obviously, with that many states requiring the reporting, it really leaves a lot of questions as to what happened last year or the year before when these companies weren't required. How many breaches occurred that we don't know about?
Well, we're asking ourselves similar questions here in Australia because we're currently considering introducing similar laws at a federal level. So it's definitely a hot topic on this hemisphere where people wear shoes on their heads and hamburgers eat people.
Exactly. And it's something that the citizens should definitely push for. You know, they have a right to know when their information is compromised and when it may impact their lives in that kind of scale.
That was Brian Martin there on the phone from the USA. And before we get into this week's second feature interview, we should go through this quick list of Australian Information Security Association meetings that are coming up right now. So Wednesday, 26th of March, today at 5:15 p.m., we'll see an ASA meeting in Perth, and that is at the atrium in the SGIO building. And the topic of that meeting is risk management, doing more than keeping the light on. Brisbane's next meeting will take place this Thursday, the 27th of March at 5:15 p.m. for a 5:30 start. And that is going to be at BDO Kendall's on level 15, 300 Queen Street, Brisbane. The topic of that meeting is security, organisational structures and teams, a discussion. In Adelaide, the next meeting will be on the 31st of March at 4 p.m. at Servcorp's boardroom on level 24 Westpac House, which is 97 King William Street. More information on those meetings is available at asa.org.au. It's time now to have a chat to Declan Ingram for Securus Global in this week's feature interview. You might remember his talk on IDS and IPS, finding its way into a Risky Business podcast a couple of months ago. Well, Declan's noticed an interesting trend in the marketplace lately, and he's come onto the show to chat about it. Apparently, Australian enterprises keep ringing him up, claiming to have been hacked in a pretty serious way, but they're not really interested in doing a full forensic recovery because it's simply too expensive.
They're concentrating so hard on actually getting the servers back up and running. You know, I mean, people, especially online businesses that we deal with a lot, you know, their servers, their web interface, their web shops, that's their business. And without that, they can't do business.
And so to do a forensic recovery, quite often that would mean downtime, right?
It's not always downtime, but it often is downtime. There are no short answers. You know, it's very difficult to come up here and say, you know, this is exactly the process. It will take this long. And it's likewise very difficult when you're engaging with a potential customer about a forensic investigation to say, okay, you know, it will take us this long to do this, this long to do that. Because quite oftentimes they just say, okay, weird stuff has been going on for this period of time, and we're a bit concerned about exactly what it might be.
Thank you very much. So that's the haystack, and they're pretty much saying, go and find the needle, right?
Yeah. Sometimes it's as much as, you know, we've had complaints about various things, and we're trying to work out what's going on. Can you please come and help us work out what's going on? Is usually the extent. It's more often than not, it's a hand-holding exercise. Then all the way to the other end of the scale, where you might have, you know, a major server owned by that company, which is serving a whole heap of, you know, movies and things like that to the greater internet that you know, obviously shouldn't be there.
Or you might even have the receptionist come down and say, hey, I just found our entire customer database on BitTorrent.
That's happened as well. as an aside, peer-to-peer hacking, very interesting. Search for all sorts of crazy things. Just think of it as Google hacking. It's just like Google hacking.
So you can find people's documents and all sorts of stuff in shared directories, yeah. I guess, you know, what I'm wondering is in practical terms why people are reluctant. I would have thought that in the majority of, you know, decent e-commerce setups, you're going to have a lot of mirror disks. I mean, can't you just pop out a mirror disk, chuck another blank disk in the caddy, you know, have it mirror, and then walk away with the evidence? Or why is it such a headache just to grab that initial snapshot?
To have a legally verifiable chain of evidence is an expensive and convoluted process. To go through and gain everything that's needed so that you can stand up in court and say, this happened this point in time by these people and we can verify it this particular way. When you're on a large, complex series of systems with big, you know, big disks and RAID and everything else, it gets very complicated very quickly. And the software training and equipment that you need to do that is also very, very expensive too.
So I guess really what you're saying is unless there's going to be, you know, unless you're talking about a really high profile lawsuit or something like that where people are seeking serious damages and there's a lot of money involved, if you've just been pwned and there's no one you can really seek remedy against, it almost seems like you're suggesting it's not really worth it doing a full forensic, you know, chain of evidence type of examination on the targeted systems.
Yeah, like anything else, it's a balance between the cost and the benefit. And if it's going to cost you $50,000 to investigate a small incident and go through all the different bits and pieces, then you're going to need to you know, be able to benefit from that. If you've got an extremely large case, if you're a large organisation and something very serious has happened, you're going to go through that full extent of the evidence. You know, a lot of the time, if it's just a small site, you know, organisations just don't have the budget to just start splashing out on an enormous incident that they, you know, 24 hours previously, they had no idea would occur.
So really, I guess the approach is to just get the servers back up and running, try to figure out what the hell happened, close the hole, and watch for similar activity. I mean, is that really what you find customers are instructing you to do?
Yeah.
There was this like little sad look of depression that just passed over your face when you said that. But, you know, it must be quite frustrating, really, just letting people get away with this stuff when you're the ones who have to, you know, proverbially, I guess, walk behind the elephant with the shovel. You know, it must be a little bit frustrating.
Yeah, the visuals on that.
Do you think we're lacking the tools that would really help to automate that process and make it significantly cheaper?
I think that the tools are there. I think that the process is there. I think that where the problem really lies is the whole. If you look at it as a system from the technical guy who's actually going through and getting the evidence from the disks, from the network, from the logs, going through and correlating all of that, all the way through to the legal representatives who stand up in court, who can explain the stuff to the juries in the criminal court and say, you know, this is what happens, this is that. To get that entire, if you think about that whole process of a system, I mean, it's a very difficult to get all of these people to communicate, to know exactly what's required by the other people in the system.
I remember a number of years ago there was a whole bunch of hoo-ha over the idea that you could have your logs independently signed and cryptographically signed for this precise reason, so that you wouldn't have to go through an extremely expensive process to actually have some form of evidence that a court could rely upon. So if you're logging all of your Apache logs and having them signed, you know, using some sort of key and the date and the time as a component of that, so you can cryptographically prove that this log did in fact go into that file at that time. Are you seeing organizations implementing those sorts of systems?
Fundamentally, no. We're not seeing that. And there are many reasons why, but the main one is that there are no greenfields IT systems. Realistically, you just don't see very many brand new systems that are put in without any legacy data, any legacy systems, any other sort of bits and pieces that join into it. There are organizational-wide logging systems that have got all sorts of fancy bells and whistles that make them secure, and you know, there are going to be vulnerabilities in those systems. If the past is any indication of the future, just because a system is a security system doesn't mean that it's not going to have security flaws. So that's one thing to be very, very careful of and to think about. But, I mean, we're just not seeing these implemented fundamentally. To be honest with you, in all of my testing and incident response experience, I've never seen one.
But I understand one of the problems with those types of systems, these secure logging systems, is that possibly an attacker could inject other data into the log before it's cryptographically signed.
If you're attacking a web server and the web server is sending its logs over to a third party, and you know, you've got to a point where, you know, your initial attack has been logged. It has been sent. You haven't got to a point where you've manipulated that. However, you've now compromised the web server, and you can make the web server send whatever logs, because you've got some form of trust between the web server and the logging server. The log server is obviously accepting information from the web server. And so you just start to send it erroneous logs, funky logs. You know, hi, it was here. If you can inject any form of information into the system, into the logging system or any other system that's collecting the data, that would cause, that could prove that it had been manipulated or could have been manipulated, that's pretty much all that you need.
You know, I think I might embark on a career as an evil overlord hacker, because it sounds like it's a pretty difficult crime to prosecute.
It's a very difficult crime to prosecute. And a gentleman that I used to work with, who used to work at the AFP, said off the cuff at one afternoon that the only way that the AFP could prosecute people is once their girlfriends dob them in.
That's quite nice. Or they actually catch them in the act. It would be the equivalent of catching them holding the axe while it's actually embedded in someone's head.
Yeah, basically. If there's a root shell on their machine when they knock on the door, they've probably got something.
Well, I actually heard a similar comment from an Australian Federal Police officer, which is that it's very difficult to prosecute after the fact. They need to be tipped on it, and then they have to basically monitor that connection and wait for them to do it again.
Yeah. No, it's a really, really difficult thing. And certainly from some of the people in the legal community that I've had brief discussions with, there's not a huge amount of, to put it lightly, there's not a huge amount of technical knowledge on that side of the fence. And not only that, but as people often talk about with the forensics cases is, you know, what's the legal knowledge of the technical people doing the work? On the other side of that is you need to have some technical knowledge of the legal people doing the work. Because if someone...
I imagine if we went out and found a Supreme Court judge right now, you know, sobered him up and then tried to talk about logging and, you know, cryptography and buffer overflows, I think they'd probably run straight back to the gentleman's club, wouldn't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, it's a two-sided coin, and I think it's that integration between the legal process and between the technical people on the ground that really needs to be streamlined.
Declan Ingram there, who took some time out of a very hectic schedule to speak with Risky Business. So thanks again, Declan, for doing that. It's time now for this week's sponsor interview. Checkpoint Software is paying our bills this week, which is terribly nice of them. And we give sponsors a slot on the show so they can show you all how clever they are. After all, Risky Business listeners are the cool kids in the schoolyard, aren't you? So this week we're talking to Aviv Abramovich from Checkpoint Software here in Australia. Attackers have found a new way to use cross-site scripting to take control of consumers' systems by embedding iframe code into search queries that are cached by the target site in order to optimize their Google ranking. Google's bots come through to index the cached search results, and after a while, someone will eventually come across one of these cached results in a Google search, click on it, and get more than they bargained for. Major pwnage. But it's not all bad news. If you're running a halfway popular website that caches search results, you are going to need to take cross-site scripting a whole lot more seriously these days. But as you'll discover, it's probably a good idea to do some other stuff as well, just in case you miss some bad code. You might want to start blocking iffy tags at your network boundary as well.
Specific websites are not filtering the inputs they received in their search queries correctly, and they're just caching the results, which means This can be a very widespread phenomenon, as we've seen, actually.
So, I mean, really, if we just find any website that doesn't filter its search input correctly, we can start injecting those iframe scripts into it, and those search results will actually have an iframe tag embedded in them, and, of course, those search results are being cached by that website to optimize their search engine results, and... yeah, bang, people are clicking straight through from Google. But really, it's not Google's fault, is it? It's really the fault of the local webmaster.
Yes, that's correct. It's not the search engine's fault. It's the application of that search engine that is that can be the fault. It can happen on a totally different search engine or a totally different type of form or query, basically. So, no, it's not Google's fault. And I would even say further, it doesn't have to be the iframe script. It can be any form of script that can do any malicious thing that can be injected into an unsuspecting user.
Now, how much do you think this changes the game? Because previously, if you constructed some sort of malicious link using a flaw on a website that allowed you to insert badness into various fields, before you'd need to like email that link to someone and get them to click it before it would really do anything like display malicious content. This really changes the game, doesn't it?
Yes, that's true, and a bit unfortunate, I would say. Previously, as you mentioned, the trick with cross-site scripting is to entice innocent users to click on a link. Now, this changes the game a little bit because the delivery mechanism where you deliver a link with that contains an embedded script is much easier because all you have to do is, I guess, go to the wrong site. It can be, as we've seen, a site that belongs to a government agency. So for the innocent user, there's very little suspicions in the site. So all they have to do is just click on wrong link. And yes, this is essentially, I think, lift the game up a little bit. And as we've seen, there are a lot of users that got hurt by this particular cross-site scripting attack.
Now, is there much you can do at the firewall or IPS level to start filtering out iframe tags and things like that? Is that a simple solution before you go and actually tighten up all of your web code? Can you do something at the border, at the gateway?
Absolutely. With some web intelligence products, some firewall products have web intelligence capabilities. You can certainly filter out iframe or even block cross-site scripting to begin with. The users will not be able to inject malicious scripts into unsuspecting sites. But that's something you have to do on the website. That this is a defense that you have to set up on the website side, not on the on the user side, unfortunately.
So really, it is a case that website operators are putting people at risk by not locking down their servers. And while we can do some stuff at the gateway, it's probably a better idea to get some web application specialists to have a look at code and really pay extra special attention to cross-site scripting.
That's correct. At the end of the day, the ultimate solution will be, of course, to build the web application without any security flaws. But realistically, this is something that personally I find very hard to do, at least in the applications that I've seen or in most application developers that I've met. I've seen that there is a very clear delineation between the guys who are responsible for the security and the guys responsible for developing the application. And most of the time, security just gets in the way. So in most cases, what will happen is most application developers will just cut security corners, if you want, to deliver their applications sooner rather than later.
So you reckon they should be doing something at the border as well as trying to tighten up the applications?
I would say for the security administrator, definitely they need to do something at the border as well to tighten security up and not just rely on the application developer.
Okay, Aviv, well, that's all that we're going to have time for this week, mate, but thank you very much for coming on to Risky Business.
Thank you for having me. I want to be dark and silent. I
want to be haunted. Aviv Abramovich there, a security architect from Checkpoint Software, rounding out this edition of Risky Business. Thanks again to our sponsor Checkpoint Software and our hosting partner Vigabyte. This week's Sound Foundation track is by Scarlet Affection, and you can buy it at soundfoundation.com.au for $1.30. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening. I want to be, I want to be.